The Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe plug-in hybrid is built for the best of both worlds. For the city buzz, for the call of the wild, for finding solitude, for sharing memories, for day trips, and for far-roaming adventures. Because with gas and electric capability, the Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe inspires you to explore more, to explore it all. Tap the banner to learn more. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
630 CHED Inside Sports with Reed Wilkins. Weekdays at 6 on 630 CHED.
Oh, I am stuffed full of turkey. How you doing, everybody? Hope you've had a great Thanksgiving. Reed Wilkins with you, Inside Sports on 630 CHED. So the Oilers setting a roster today, though I expect this will still change in time for the game on Wednesday against the Vancouver Canucks. Of course, that's the season opener. We have it for you right here on 630 CHED. Face-off show at 6. The game is going to be at 8. Now, here's how the 23-man roster looks at this very moment. 13 forwards. Connor McDavid, Leon Draisaitl, Nugent Hopkins, Hyman, Puljujarvi, Yamamoto, Derek Ryan, Zach Cassian, Warren Fogle, Devin Shore, Brendan Perlini, Tyler Benson, and Ryan McLeod. Now, Zach Cassian didn't skate today. He's still day-to-day after hitting his head on the ice in the fight against Zach MacEwen on Thursday. He did skate before the practice on his own, and Dave Tippett said, if it was up to Cassian, he'd declare himself good to go on Wednesday. We'll see if he actually is able to play in that game. Nugent Hopkins didn't skate today. He's feeling a little under the weather, not believed to be COVID-related. So Nugent Hopkins should be good for Wednesday. Kyle Turris was on the ice today. Kyle Turris cleared waivers. And then Kyle Turris was loaned to Bakersfield in the American Hockey League. This very likely to be just a paper transaction. So I would expect Turris to be at some point recalled in time to play in the game on Wednesday, as the Oilers likely just doing some maneuverings here for the salary cap heading into the season. 8 defensemen on the roster. Darnell Nurse, Tyson Barrie, Duncan Keith, Cody Ceci, Slater Koekkoek, Chris Russell, Evan Bouchard, and Philip Broberg, who earlier in training camp had been assigned to Bakersfield. So I think this is another part of the paper transaction. He's here for now. And by the time the season starts, it's going to be Turris on the NHL roster and Broberg in the minors. So keep that in mind here as we're going through this. And, of course, the two goalies, Mike Smith and Mikko Koskinen. Also of note, 2 players placed on long-term injured reserve, Oscar Klefbom with the ongoing shoulder issue, and goaltender Alex Stalock, who has myocarditis. William Lagesson, along with Turris, cleared waivers. He's been placed on injured reserve. Bit of an issue there with him. And 3 players injured non-roster status, Dylan Holloway, Dmitry Samarukov, and Josh Archibald. Of course, Archibald never really took part in training camp, and now, unfortunately, he is dealing with myocarditis. So that is the story. And again, expect Turris and Broberg to flip where they are now for the game Wednesday against Vancouver. Broberg would be back in the minors, and Turris would be with the Oilers, and I mean, very likely playing in that game, obviously. Dave Tippett talked a little bit today about Turris, about Ryan McLeod, and about Tyler Benson and how camp shook down for these guys.
Kyle on waivers, there's a lot more to it than Kyle being on waivers. And, you know, Kyle had a really good camp. We didn't want to lose him. So, and the other 2 players, Mac doesn't have to clear waivers, but we think he's close to making our lineup. I think Devin Shore played better than him in camp, and through camp, and so Devin Shore is going to start in that position. And on the left wing, we had a number of guys there that Perlini played better than Benson did in camp. That's so, as it looks right now, depending on some injury stuff, McLeod and Benson will be the odd guys out at forward. And that line of Shore and Perlini and Turris played well, so they just won the spot. They won the spot in for the opening roster. Now, where it goes from there, things change quickly, as you know, Jim.
All right, so that's how it looked there. Now, Colton Sevier continues practicing with the Oilers as well, and he does not have a contract. He remains on a professional tryout, so we don't know what's going to happen with him. Another possibility is that he is signed before Wednesday's game, and maybe plays in place of Zach Cassian, and Cassian could be placed on injured reserve. So that's another thing to keep in mind there. We'll see what happens with Sevier. Tippett said they'll continue to talk to Sevier here, and some sort of decision will be made in the next couple of days. So, look, this is the roster for now. As we know, it always changes. There's always a lot of speculation and hype around the opening day roster, but that's how this one looks at the moment. The goaltenders, Smith and Koskinen, you know, good camp for Stuart Skinner, got to play again on the weekend, did pretty good against the Vancouver Canucks, but he was sent to the Bakersfield Condors. Smith and Koskinen are going to be the goalies, and probably a pretty even split between these two guys.
I don't know if we'll go back to that exact thing there, but we're going to keep both of them going. Not one guy won't be out of the net for a long time.
Okay, and the Oilers heading into this year in a division that is not overly strong, the Pacific Division, and certainly Vegas, I think, by most people, seen as the number one team, and then I think you'd probably have a consensus that the Oilers will finish second in the division. Hey, what do predictions get you? They're fun to talk about until the actual action starts, but that's what we're looking at right now. The Oilers coming off two pretty decent regular seasons, both which led to pretty quick playoff exits, and Dave Tippett today addressed the expectations for the upcoming year.
Well, we've talked about continuing to build what we've been doing and get better. So our expectations are to improve over last year and keep moving forward. So in that sense, yeah, our expectations are higher than last year. We want to continue to improve. And, you know, we've, like you say, we've added some players to our group that I think help us, but you can put all the names on the paper you want. You still got to get out on the ice and do it. And you got to do it each and every night. And if you want to become like we've been 12th and 11th the last couple of years, now we want to be in the top 10. We want to get in that top 10 and keep pushing forward. But you got to play strong, consistent hockey. You've got to play well as a team. You got to get a few breaks along the way. Injuries can be a factor. So there's all those factors that come into play. But our expectation is we want to continue to improve and see where that takes us.
Okay, so that's where we stand right now for the Oilers. And you can get more on the roster on 630ched.com or globalnews.ca as we get you ready for the home opener coming up on Wednesday night. It, of course, has been a tough, tough go for the Edmonton Elks. Just two wins in eight games. They were pretty thoroughly throttled by the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, 33 on Friday in Winnipeg. They got to play the league leaders again on Friday at Commonwealth. And a major change here for the Edmonton Elks. Trevor Harris will not be the quarterback. They are taking out the veteran. Harris has struggled for the most part this year. I mean, really one really good game on Labor Day and has been at best inconsistent, I think, since then, and in some games, has looked quite poor, to be frank. So what's happening here? Well, Taylor Cornelius is going to be the guy. We've seen him play, and the Elks are deciding to go with Cornelius and a little bit of Dakota Prukop as well along the way. We've seen him kind of come in as a bit of a change of pace quarterback here for the Elks this season. Here's head coach Jamie Elizondo on this decision.
For a number of different reasons, we're not getting the play that we need from the quarterback position, and it's not just him. Anytime you're 2-6, it's everybody. But we just feel that right now those guys give us the best combination, you know, to be able to move the ball down the field, get in rhythm, do some things.
All right, pretty significant stuff here as the Elks get ready for Friday night's game. Hey, hope you've had a happy Thanksgiving. We got a best of Inside Sports tonight. We're going to hear some of our best interviews in recent weeks, starting with Ryan Nugent-Hopkins when we get back. Of course, you know Ryan Nugent-Hopkins as a forward for the Edmonton Oilers, going into his 11th season in the NHL, but he's also the owner of racehorses, and one of them, Infinite Patience, won the Northlands Distaff back on September 11th. Talked to Nuge a couple days after that victory.
Yeah, it was exciting. It was, we've been very fortunate with her the whole way along. She's a pretty special filly, so just happy to be along for the ride. And it was a great day. It was awesome to see tons of people out there, everybody having a good time. And it was a meaningful day for that track and just racing in general in Western Canada. So it was a good day out there.
So are you the type of owner, are you Do you watch the race? Are you too nervous? Do you have to not watch it? Because, you know, you always hear, you know, some parents get too nervous to watch their kids or whatever. So, so horse owner, do you watch, or do you need to just get told the result after?
No, I definitely watch. I still get nervous, but I got to watch. It's tough to, I don't want to just know the result. I need to watch and kind of see everything playing out as it happens. So I was glued to it. I was obviously a little nervous. It was a tough group of fillies and mares she was running against. So we knew how good she can be, but you never know how it's going to go. But definitely, I always like to watch them.
All right. So in terms of Infinite Patience, and she's had a great run, you know, 8 wins and 13 career starts. So that's excellent. And, you know, from the hockey world, players get scouted. You know, someone like you was identified as a top prospect. You get picked first overall and off you go. In the world of horse racing, like, when do you know when you have something, when you might have a high quality horse of like Infinite Patience? Do you know when they're really young, maybe before they're even in a couple of races, or do you need to see them on the track several times before you really feel sure?
You can tell during their training usually. Some are harder to see it. With her, it was pretty obvious that she was going to have be a talented horse. And she was owned by an owner who used the same trainer as me, and I would watch her train, and I could see how special she was. So I tried to kind of partner with the guy, and he didn't want to do it at first. And then she ran once and won pretty easily. So I tried again, and luckily enough, Bill DeCourcy is my partner, and he let me partner with him. So I've been ever since after her first race. So I've been part of 12 races with her, and it was pretty obvious with her that from a young age that she was going to be pretty special. And it doesn't always work out like that. Sometimes they can look good and not end up running that well, or sometimes they don't look great and they end up being good. So I think it's kind of like any sport. Some of them just show signs early and stick with it. Some of them are late bloomers.
So as an owner, I'm wondering how involved you are on a day-to-day basis with decisions made surrounding the horse. I mean, obviously as an owner, you're going to be involved, but I can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm wondering too, if there's times you got to step back and leave it to the trainers and the jockeys and the people who are experts in those specialized positions. So how involved do you get, or when do you need to get involved?
I almost always leave it up to our trainer, and my partner Bill's the same way, but I have a couple more horses with my trainer Barb Heads, and her number one priority is taking care of the horses, and she only puts them in good spots and make sure that they're happy and healthy. And so I mean, the day-to-day stuff, the hands-on stuff, I'm completely hands off. She takes care of that. She's got great help too, and her husband Mike helps out a lot too. So I trust them 100%, and they know what they're doing. Whereas the hands-on stuff, I definitely wouldn't know. So the day-to-day stuff, I definitely just sit back and let whatever happens. And the only stuff that I kind of have a say in is where she's going to run, or which race to go in, and that's usually up to Barb.
Okay, I'm going to ask you something some people have asked me about, the name Infinite Patience. So that she already had that name, or did you guys come up with it?
No, she already had that name. So okay. Bill named her. I think the story is him and his wife have been together for 40 something years, I believe, and his wife Noy has had to have infinite patience to stick with him that long. So I think that's kind of where they got the name, and I obviously didn't have anything to do with that.
Okay, that's a good clarity, because people were wondering if you came up with that name as a reference to your hockey career or something like that. So okay.
Oh no, nothing like that.
that settles that. Remind everybody, you know, how you got into this. This is a really cool thing to to own racehorses? I mean, it's a very unique sport. Did this blossom for you during your pro hockey career, or even, you know, going back to a kid playing for the Red Deer Rebels, or even before that, did you think that was a world that maybe one day you would want to live in a bit?
Well, my brother and I kind of grew up going to the racetrack. We didn't live on a farm or anything, but we went to the racetrack pretty much every weekend as kids. My dad used to be involved and own some horses, and my grandpa on my mom's side, same thing with him, and they'd be at the track quite often. So we just kind of grew up around the horses and around the racetrack, and it was something that I didn't think I'd be involved in, but an opportunity came when I was a little younger after my first couple of years in the league, and I took it, and it's been a lot of fun. So it's definitely a fun thing to be involved in. There's obviously ups and downs, but I've definitely enjoyed my experience to this point.
So how do you compare or contrast the competitive world of the National Hockey League to the competitive world of horse racing? Are there any parallels, or are they a totally different environment?
No, there's competitiveness for sure. Even during the races, there's definitely the jockeys. They're competitive. They're battling against each other. They'll box each other out sometimes, and they have their different strategies and whatnot. And the trainers and the owners, they kind of put the horses in certain positions in certain races to have more success or to avoid running against a certain one. So there's definitely some comparables, I think, in any sport kind of thing. There's always going to be that competitiveness.
Ryan Nugent Hopkins joining us tonight on Inside Sports. His horse, Infinite Patience, winning the Northlands Distaff on Saturday, part of Canadian Derby Day. Did you get any teammates out or interested on Saturday?
Well, some of them are definitely interested, and I didn't have anybody out. I had my wife's brother and his wife and kids came up, and then obviously my partner Bill and his family and Barb and stuff. But it was a busy day. I know if we had some of the guys out, they would have been a little busy for them. So maybe especially on a busy day like that. But maybe for the next one, I'll try to get some guys out.
Okay, and tell me about that next one. I mean, I referenced Infinite Patience career record, very good, and this outstanding season this year, 3 wins in 5 starts. So what is next for Infinite Patience? Where do you go from here?
Well, she's eligible for the sale stake on October 15th, so in Edmonton, so we'll probably run her in that race. And then there's another race at the end of the month, October, that she might run in. She might not run in that one. We'll just play by ear, and I'll let Barbara make that call. But she's had a lot of success. We sent her to Toronto last year, and had a good first race. And then she really didn't like the track too much. It's that synthetic. It's not actual dirt. It's synthetic out there, so she didn't like that. It was very hot too out there. But other than that, she kind of came back this year and took her race to find herself again. And it's like any sport, confidence is a big thing. So she's found her confidence again, and she's been running great.
Yeah, Ryan Nugent Hopkins going to have to keep an eye on that that other career he has, owning racehorses. It's the best of Inside Sports on 630 CHED. Pete Peters and Ricky Ray coming up. Well, we got a whale of a story for you here. Best of Inside Sports on 630 CHED, looking back on some of our favorite interviews in recent weeks. I talked to former NHL goaltender Pete Peters, who found himself in the news. He went fishing and he got a record-setting catch of a sturgeon about 11 and a half feet long.
Well, I got invited on a fishing trip by my son's father-in-law, Barry Botel, and I went with his brother, Bryant, and Jake Drieger, and we went with the sturgeon slayers, the guy that owns the company and the guide, Kevin Estrada, and we fished for 3 days, and I'd never fished for sturgeon before. I'd seen the pictures, but like all fish stories, you know, you're wondering if this is for real. And, yeah, so the first 2 days we were catching sturgeon anywhere from 6 feet to 8.5 feet. And then the last day we went, we caught the world's record at 11 feet, 6 inches, 880 pounds.
Oh, okay. Sorry, where was this again?
It was on the Fraser River in British Columbia. And we were between Chilliwack and Hope, B.C.
Okay, and what day was this? How long ago was this?
This was August 15th.
Okay, so a couple of weeks ago. All right, so when you reel in a fish of that size, did it ever cross your mind? I mean, obviously you knew it was bigger than normal. Did it ever cross your mind it could be a record breaker or what?
Well, Kevin Estrada, the guide, he'd been tracking a fish. You know, he knows his holes, and he has a unique sonar, a fishing sonar, and he'd been tracking in this one particular hole for 3 weeks. There was a big sturgeon coming in and out of the hole. Now, whether that was a sturgeon we caught, we don't know. But anyways, the last day we went back to this hole, and all of a sudden we had a sturgeon on, and I was up, and so they handed me the rod, and so I knew I had something pretty heavy because I had a 6 and 7 footer before, and this just felt a lot stronger or heavier on the rod. And then all of a sudden the thing went aerial, and it's absolutely amazing to see a fish, you know, 11 feet long, 880 pounds, come totally out of the water, like totally out of the water, trying to shake that hook. And unless you've seen it, it's hard to believe that they can fly and go aerial like that. But, oh, that's when we knew we had something big.
All right, so what was it like actually hauling it into the boat? I have no experience with this kind of stuff. So what's that process involve?
So the sturgeon is a protected species, and you want to keep it in the water at all times. So we worked it for half an hour, and it finally got tired, so I could only go for about 15 minutes. It took about everything I had, and then I passed the rod on to Jake Drager, and he's younger and stronger than I am, and he brought it home, and so we got it into about 4 feet of water. So when we got it in 4 feet of water, the guide gets out of the boat, and when you turn the sturgeon on its back, it goes totally docile. So then we, the boat got anchored, and we're in about 4 feet of water. So they, you know, the fish is handled with supreme care. And we started measuring. And then Kevin Estrada, the guide, he called upriver and downriver, and a couple guides came to verify the measurements. And everybody was in agreement that it was 11 feet, 6 inches, and it was a new world's record.
And then it goes back into the water. Is that like that day it's so, right back in the water? Yeah.
Yeah. So then the other thing that the guides do is they have a scanner, and they scan the sturgeon to see if it has a chip in it. And this fish had never been caught before, so then the guide puts a chip in it so that they can study the history of this fish in case somebody else reels it in. And when we've done that, then we roll the fish over and we walk him out to about 6 feet of water. And then he was so tired, he just kind of was hanging out at about 6 or 7 feet. And we got some unbelievable pictures of it just hanging out because it was actually in some clear water. And, it was pretty tired. He tired us up, too. And then eventually he worked his way back into the deep water, and we called it a day.
Well, I'm looking at, there's several publications that have written about you and your buddies catching this fish, and I'm looking on USA Today, and there's a photo with five of you guys in the water with the fish. And yeah, 11 and a half feet. It is a massive animal, and cool to hear that he's back out there and swimming around, and maybe he's going to encounter some other people at some point in his life. So that is pretty cool. Pete Peters, former NHL goalie, joining us tonight on Inside Sports, telling you about his record-setting sturgeon catch in the Fraser River on August 15th. Now, for you, has fishing always been a part of your life? Is it a post-hockey thing? What's your relationship with fishing?
Well, you know, there's passionate people, like there's passionate people about golf, and there's passionate people, we'll say, with tennis or, you know, fishing or water skiing. Or I wouldn't categorize myself as a passionate fisherman where I have to fish every day. I do enjoy going fishing, and, you know, I like catching them. I got no problem throwing them back. It is fun. I wouldn't consider myself an avid fisherman with a huge passion, but I definitely enjoy it. And we're going back out there again next year because it's just an absolute thrill to witness these fish. Like, the guide figured this fish was about 100 years old.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. So that is absolutely amazing. And then you know, like when they measure the fish for the official length, they measure it from the snout to the fork of the tail. But then the tail's another 2.5 feet long. So,
jeez.
when you see this thing, it's hard to fathom.
So wait, the 11.5 feet does not include the tail?
Correct.
My goodness. Okay. So that's like... It's like two Chris Prongers, almost all of that under the water.
Well, yeah, with an attitude.
Yeah, more of an attitude than Pronger. That is cool. Well, thanks for sharing that story. That's awesome stuff. Pete Peters joining us tonight on Inside Sports. And, of course, former National Hockey League goaltender. You grew up in Edmonton, and you continue to live here in the area. So I know that'll make people happy, even though hockey took you, as it does for a lot of people around the West and around parts of Canada and the United States. I mean, look, I mentioned you won the Vezina Trophy in 1983. You were on the Canada Cup team in 1984, which is not a hard, which is not an easy roster to crack. I mean, you had a 40-win season. You had a lot of other years you won in the high 20s. I mean, look, Pete, I don't know how you look back on it, but I remember you a little bit from when I was younger. You know, there was a good chunk of your career where you would have been considered on a very short list of one of the best goalies in the NHL.
Well, Reed, that's very kind of you to say. Playing on the East Coast, it's different, you know. Like, it would have been, you know, like you play in Washington, D.C. at that time, which was, you know, kind of the farthest south team. And I don't mean it in a negative way, but you kind of play in anonymity sometimes, which is a good thing, you know, like, whereas opposed to being in Canada, you know, you can't even go to the grocery store, from what I understand, with some of these people that have played in Canada. But, it's been I lived my childhood dream, let's put it that way, and when we talked about passion before, my passion was always hockey. So,
well, and you were part of the Flyers team. What did you guys go 36 games, I think, without a loss in 1980, and unfortunately came up just short in the finals against the Islanders. I know a lot of Flyers fans will say that Nystrom goal was offside. You know, Boston usually had a good team. When you joined Washington, they were finally coming out of their doldrums. They hadn't been very good for a long time. But, like, was that 79-80 Flyers team the best team you played on, or am I missing somebody maybe along the way?
No. Every team I played for, the fans were great. The cities were great. Probably the best team I ever played on was the 84 Canada Cup. To this day, I if I go into you know, one of my rooms in the house, and I look at that 84 Canada Cup team, and I look at the pitcher, and I'm just like, what am I doing with that hockey team? Like, you know, when you look at all of the stars, and the 84 team is never talked about. It's funny how it's never comes into a conversation of, you know, like the 87 team or, you know, the 72 team or whatever. But in that 84 Canada Cup team, you know, Glenn Sather was a coach with Muckler and Green. And we were on the verge of getting boinked out of that tournament. And, yeah, I love playing for Glenn Sather. I mean, you know, Muck was the X's and O's guys, but I'll tell you, Slotz, he knew what buttons to push, and he knew whether, you know, X player needed a kick in the butt or Y player needed to be stroked. And he's, you know, that's when the Oilers and Islanders were fighting for the cup all the time. And so, yeah, one night he straightened that all out in Vancouver in the dressing room. And the team took off then, and, you know, that was the game in Calgary where Coffey stopped that 2-on-1 in overtime, and we went back down and scored in overtime and beat them 3-2 and the Russians in 3-2, and then we ended up beating the Swedes the best 2 out of 3, and we won the cup. But I still think of the players that I played with, and Glenn Sather, like, to me, was a dream to play for, because He had his hands full, really, with that dressing room, you know, because it was split. Half of it was Islanders, half of it was Oilers.
So I wanted to ask you that. And first of all, you're right. That team probably doesn't get the recognition it deserves. And perhaps it's because, like you said, you had a couple blips early in the tournament and went into the playoffs as the fourth seed out of six. But we've heard that. You have all those Islanders, all those Oilers. They'd met in a couple cup finals. Didn't get along. How did Glenn straighten it out? Do you remember what he did?
Well, I can't repeat it on the air.
Well, if you can sort of, yes, you might have to substitute some of the language.
I'll try to do it without any expletives. I didn't play well that night in Vancouver, so when the game was over, like, that was the first international stuff that I ever played in, and I felt I let the team down, and I thought, okay, you better suck it up, because Slotz might tear a strip off you. And that was the furthest thing that happened. Slotz came in there and he looked at all the Islanders, and you got to imagine the players he's looking at, and he just said, this Oilers Islander stuff has to stop now. And he said, if it doesn't stop, he says, we're going to get boinked out of this tournament. And then he spun on the Oilers, and he said, if you guys shaft me, I'll trade every one of you. And the team flipped. It did an about face. Like, he didn't rant and rave. He just called a spade a spade, left the room. And then I think maybe the next game we played was in Edmonton against the Russians, and that's when Mess threw that big elbow behind the net. The Russian was spread all over the ice, and I think that was a big turning point for us then, too.
That's a great story. Pete, we're a little short on time. We're going to have to try to catch up again. Maybe during the Oilers season we can get you on a pregame show, and we can get Rob Brown to talk to you as well, because I'd love to hear you guys tell some stories with each other. But I'll end with this for tonight.
I think I made Rob famous, too. He scored a bunch on me.
Yeah, that's right. He had a couple years where he was scoring on a lot of guys. Absolutely. What goaltender do you watch now? Where you think, you know, where you really like the way he plays, or is there anybody that maybe reminds you of yourself a little bit?
Well, you know, I would have to say Vasilevskiy is the man now in the National Hockey League. Like, with his size and his athleticism and his determination, he, you know, like, kind of like a Grant Fury. Yeah, I might let one in, but you're not getting any more. So yeah, Vasilevskiy would be the guy I admire the most, I think.
That is Pete Peters. Man, oh, man, cool to catch up with him. We'll have to talk to him again. The Best of Inside Sports continues in a couple of minutes with Ricky Ray and his running. One of the all-time greats ever to wear the double E is Ricky Ray as we continue with our Best of Inside Sports edition tonight. Talked to Ricky a couple of weeks ago. We did talk about football, but he told a really good story here about what he's been up to athletically lately, and he has totally embraced distance running.
Yeah, so to kind of keep my competitive desire going, I've been doing some distance running. I did some trail races, a half marathon. So I've been doing that to kind of keep me in shape and, you know, keep me working at something. And kind of, like I said, keeps me, you know, a little bit competitive out there now that I don't have football.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, I started running, I guess, about 12 or 13 years ago. I'm up to a dozen half marathons over the years. A couple marathons, but that never again, Ricky, because my knees almost exploded. But like, do you run daily? Do you get out every second day? And what distances do you usually tackle just for kind of an everyday run?
Yeah, I've been trying to run 6 days a week. I try and get about anywhere, you know, around 30 to 35 miles in per week. The longest race I've done, I did a 50K, which I think is around the 30-mile mark, is the longest trail race I did. Man, that was tough. I think it took me like 7 hours to do it. So, but then I've done one half marathon, and then I kind of got into it, and then obviously everything started happening with coronavirus, and haven't been able to race much the last, year and a half, 2 years. But I was able to get a few races under my belt and hopefully, make a lot more races, do a lot more half marathons, and hopefully do a marathon one day.
All right, so these trail races, like 50K, that is significant. For people who don't know, a half marathon is 21K, a full marathon is 42K, and the 50K trail races, is this one of those where you are in the wilderness and there might even be a little bit of climbing involved and bad footing and small trails? Like, was it that intense?
Yeah. I mean, it was a lot of climbing. I forget how many feet it was, something maybe like 6,000 feet of climbing. Throughout the course, and man, it was a lot of fun. It was up in the wilderness, pretty close to my hometown of Reading, about an hour away. And that's why I kind of got into trail running from the beginning. Was it just gave me a chance to kind of get outside and just see nature. And it was a quicker way than hiking around. Trail running, you get out and you get to see a little bit more, cover some more ground and see some more areas. And we got some great trails here in Reading, and I've got some friends that do it too. So it was just a lot of fun to get out there and do it. I mean, the race was very difficult. A lot of the time you spend hiking, especially going up the hills, and you try and run the downhills and the flats, but man, my body was pretty more sore than my legs were more sore than any football game I played, I'll tell you that.
That's Ricky Ray. Wish him all the best as he continues to run. We got the 7 o'clock news and weather coming up, and we got more of the Best of Inside Sports with a couple of really inspirational stories in the next hour.
630 CHED Inside Sports with Reed Wilkins. Weekdays at 6 on 630 CHED.